my privilege again to present Father Coughlin in one of his most important addresses. I consider it important because an affirmative answer to the question he is about to suggest definitely will keep America out of war. A negative answer, or even your silence, will contribute to engage America with millions of troops and billions of dollars actively in the European war now being waged. The analysis which Father Coughlin is about to make for you today is clear, concise, and conclusive. Hundreds of thousands of persons, for the first time aware of the emergency which is upon us, will want copies of this address. Copies can be obtained by writing directly to Father Coughlin this week. Further information on the subject of this emergency will be carried in the pages of next week's issue of Social Justice Magazine, which we invite you to secure either by subscribing for directly or from your newsboy on the street. May I assure you that your letters and comments will be carefully scanned by Father Coughlin, who is anxious to learn of your reaction. Whether you can contribute or not to maintain these fully paid-for broadcasts on the air, write to Father Coughlin to give him your views and, at least, your moral support in this, one of the greatest campaigns on which he has entered. And now I present Father Coughlin to you, who will discuss the subject of cash and carry. Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, last spring, when attempts were made to modify the existing neutrality bill, the United States Congress very dramatically refused to do so. At that time, it was pointed out that our present neutrality bill prevents our shipping arms, munitions, and certain other materials to any nation engaged in war. For it was contended by the majority of congressmen that should we Americans, directly or indirectly, either sell airplanes, cannon, shrapnel, or extend credit for the continuance of hostilities to a warring nation, we would be engaging in foreign entanglements. Opposed to this viewpoint were many prominent congressmen and citizens. Opposed to it was the President of the United States and his government. They contended that we would not be entangling ourselves in overseas quarrels if we adopted a cash and carry plan, that we would be justified in permitting a foreign nation to place orders for war material with American industries, provided the ships of these foreign nations and not American ships would transport the finished product and pay for it in cash, not credit, before the cargo left the United States. After these two viewpoints were thoroughly discussed, the neutrality bill now existing and now forbidding even the cash and carry proposition was upheld. Since the outbreak of the European War, which may become a world war of long duration, the advocates of cash and carryism again are active. Although Mr. Roosevelt clearly and definitely stated that the present non-cash and non-carry legislation will be observed without any qualification, yet he constantly refers to it as the so-called neutrality bill. He is being pressured by Mr. Saul Bloom and others to convene Congress in a special session for the purpose of modifying this bill. It is evident that the proponents of cash and carryism have more supporters now than they had last spring. A private poll of congressmen indicates that as late as last week, at least 15% of those who were satisfied with the original neutrality bill are now dissatisfied with it. and are prepared to support any modification which will permit the citizens of the United States to trade in war materials with foreign nations on a cash and carry basis. Moreover, it seems that many citizens, influenced by propaganda, entertain the opinion that a neutrality bill with a cash and carry provision will be advantageous to the United States. They contend that it will solve the unemployment problem, raise prices for the farmer, and restore prosperity. As a result of these popular contentions, I am inclined to think that a special session of Congress will be called. And I am inclined to judge that the present Neutrality Act will be modified. The arguments relative to employment, prices, and profits for all, these will prevail, provided the European war is not terminated within the next few weeks. And this is not a probability. Today, when confronted with the likelihood of a special session of Congress and the adoption of a neutrality bill, which will place us in the category, at least of indirect participants in the war, permit me to advance my personal views which concern this subject. As the advantages and disadvantages of the cash and carry plan will be discussed, some congressmen will emphasize the fact that such a program will benefit England, France, Poland, and the Allies to the disadvantage of Germany. It will be said that Germany's merchant marine has been driven from the seven seas. It will be pointed out that Germany's navy is incompetent to risk encounter with the combined navies of England and France. And it will be concluded that in view of these circumstances, a neutrality bill which includes a cash and carry clause definitely will not be a neutrality bill, but will be a bill to aid the Allies. Other congressmen admitting these facts nevertheless will support the new proposal. They will say, and with considerable justification on their side, that German Nazism must be defeated, not only because it has oppressed racial minorities, but because it militates against Christianity. And still other congressmen will observe that they are not interested as neutrals in discussing moral questions relating to the righteous cause of the Allies or the iniquitous cause of the Germans. They are interested only in an economic approach to the problem of unemployment in America, and therefore will maintain that a cash and carry policy, irrespective of its fairness or morality, is profitable for our country. All these and more arguments will exert a powerful influence as the debate progresses. Although I foresee the acceptance of the cash and carry proposal, nevertheless, I am not prepared to recommend it. I consider it a dangerous proposal, because it is a first step which inevitably leads to the last step of our directly participating in a world war, because it will wed our destinies to those of England and France, and because it will condition us within 1 or 2 years to become active allies. I uphold these opinions first, because every indication points that a cash and carry program will evolve into a credit and carry program. Already the opinion has been expressed by officials at Washington that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, headed by Mr. Jesse Jones, should be considered not as a branch of government, but as an independent corporation capable of lending credit even to nations which have failed to pay the debts arising from the last war. These same officials maintain that the restrictions of the Johnson Bill, which forbid the government's lending credit to certain foreign nations, do not apply to the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. However, this hair-splitting legality does not erase from our minds the knowledge that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation is a part of the government, that its financial obligations are the obligations of the American public, and that Mr. Jones, the head of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, has been given a post in the president's cabinet. These, I confess, are mere indications that we are preparing to adopt a policy of cash and carry. Are we engaging in foolish speculation when we say that cash will become credit? Have we other arguments besides the official opinions expressed at Washington relative to the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to confirm our opinion? Assuredly, yes. We are aware that England has practically renounced the gold standard. We are aware that in the first week of the present war, England turned on her printing presses and manufactured 24 million pounds, equivalent to $120 million of inflationary money. We are aware that both England and France have no more than $10 billion of real gold-backed cash and securities available for war purchase. We are aware that England and France have little sound cash to use in purchasing anything. Ponder upon these facts, and recollect that the last World War represented an expenditure of more than $250 billion. How far will $10 billion of real gold-backed cash go? How far, when there is every indication that the duration and the cost of the present war will exceed the duration and the cost of the world war? If the debts of the last war were practically repudiated, when both England and France were financially sound, is it not logical to anticipate that the debts of the present war also will be repudiated when the printing presses of these nations cry out that England and France are financially unsound? Before 1918, credit was regarded as sound as cash, particularly when the credit loans which Americans extended to foreign governments were guaranteed by the sovereign seal of the nations receiving the loan. Since 1918, we are forced to accept the conclusion that England's and France's credit is nothing better than a scrap of paper. And are we engaging in more foolish speculation when we contend that credit loans to warring nations are the forerunners of active participation in these nations' wars? Once more recollect that in 1916 the citizens of the United States were adamantly opposed to our entrance into the World War. The late President Wilson was re-elected to office that year after having campaigned maintained on the platform of "He kept us out of war." Presumably, President Wilson was sincere when he voiced the implied promise of keeping us out of war.
Sieged by the petitions and persuasions of the financiers and manufacturers who had extended billions of credit dollars to the Allies, Allies who were on the brink of defeat, and influenced by the Honorable Walter Page, the American ambassador to Britain, Mr. Wilson succumbed by declaring war, not to save the world for democracy, but to save the investments of the international capitalists and profiteers. Following 1918, Mr. Wilson gave expression to that thought when he characterized the world war as a commercial war. Thus, it is not an idle speculation to assume that cash and carry will become credit and carry. It is not an idle speculation to assume that the policy of issuing credits to foreign warring nations who repudiate loans is a policy that necessitates the beating of drums, which will summon our youth into the front trenches to ensure the payment of these loans. History repeats itself. Therefore, in this crucial moment, neither cast aside the basic lessons learned in the school of experience, nor permit either propaganda or unreasonable sentiment to mold your judgment. I repeat, it is a dangerous thing to advocate the inclusion of a cash and carry clause in our neutrality bill. It will deteriorate into a credit and carry clause. It will motivate rulers and their financially minded advisors to protect and ensure their investments by sending troops abroad. It will cost us the lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent boys. These were some of the fruits of the last war. It is only logical to anticipate that they will be the fruits of the next war. And if you are gifted with a modicum of foresight, picture the economic ruin which will follow in the wake of war. Factories will be closed, millions will be unemployed, and taxes will be raised. America, possessing all the commercial gold in the world, will have little use for that gold. England and France, though they be victors in the war, will be bankrupt. The paper money held by the rich and the profiteers will be confiscated or scorned. Their precious bonds will share the fate of Russian and German bonds following 1918. That, my friend, is a rough sketch of the picture. Let the brush of your own imagination fill in the details. To many persons, the morality of our engagement, even indirectly in the current European war, is questionable. To discuss the moral aspect of this war, its justice or injustice, its rightfulness or wrongfulness, one may become enmeshed in bitter controversy. Despite this risk, may I venture to recall to your attention that this war is not substantially a war between Christians and non-Christian nation. Mr. Chamberlain has stated that he is not engaging in a war against the 85 million Christian Germans. He has stated that he has entered this conflict against Hitlerism with its subjugation complex and its aggression activity. And Mr. Hitler has inferred that he is not at war with the English people, but only with the English government, the guardians of the peace treaty of Versailles. Let it be observed that Hitlerism would not be existent had not so-called Christian nations, England and France, excogitated and implemented the most un-Christian peace treaty that has desecrated the annals of civilization. I refer to the Peace Treaty of Versailles, which ran counter in many of its clauses to the Christian suggestions proposed by the late Benedict XV. It imposed a fine of $53 billion payable in gold on the German people, when there was only $11 billion of commercial gold in all the world and when their property had been confiscated. It humiliated a proud nation by subjecting it to a foreign military supervision. And the late Premier of France, Monsieur Clemenceau, whose spirit dominated the peace treaty of Versailles, vehemently excluding the use of God's name during the discussion of the treaty, cynically remarked that his grand un-Christian open was good for 11 more wars. The peace treaty of Versailles, in all its provisions, was never intended to square with Christian morality. And the Peace Treaty of Versailles, more than any other cause, was responsible for Hitlerism and for the tragedy which hangs over us today. More than that, was not the League of Nations originated to protect the injustices of the Versailles document? Were not England and France not only the main signatories of the treaty, but also the main supporters of the League? When the bitterness of the World War had been dissipated, at least in part, the two great so-called Christian nations of Great Britain and France manifested no repentance, no regret, but set about to perpetuate the injustices resulting from Versailles. England and France may be Christian nations, but the deeds of their governments at Versailles most certainly were un-Christian deeds. It is difficult, therefore, to conclude that the present upheaval is a contest between Christian and un-Christian agents. And it is incorrect to assert that all the morality is on the side of the Allies. For these two imperial forces, England and France, are greatly responsible for generating Hitlerism through the instrumentality of the Peace Treaty of Versailles. Since 1918, what have the governments of these nations contributed to rectify the injustices to which their predecessors in office were party? The mad pattern of diplomacy which they followed in the past 25 years or more is not as mad as one first suspects. If you recall, there was a London peace treaty signed between England and Italy to guarantee Italy's southern territories in Africa following her participation in the World War. Although that treaty was repudiated by England and France, their diplomats castigated Italy for demanding her share in the post-war booty. Then there was the Munich Agreement and the Polish Pact, both of which portrayed England and France as the great pacifiers, the great leaders for peace. Always they were found advocating hands-off Ethiopia, hands-off Czechoslovakia, hands-off the corridor. But never once did either England or France offer to take their hands off the territories they seized following the peace treaty of Versailles. Thus, one may not classify the injustices of Versailles as the deeds of Christian nations, any more than one may classify the activities of Hitler as the deeds of a Christian Germany. That Germany under its leader Hitler is an aggressor is readily admitted. But that England in the lifetime of Mr. Chamberlain has been a greater aggressor can likewise be substantiated. Between the years 1880 and 1890, the British seized Nigeria. They captured Somaliland. They ravaged British East Africa. They subjugated Rhodesia and the Ossaland. Before the turn of the century, British soldiery through force of arms raised the Union Jack over Uganda. Against the Boers, England sent an army of 350,000 men to capture a country notable for its vast wealth in gold and diamonds, a country inhabited and pioneered by the sturdy Dutchmen from Amsterdam. Approximately at this same time, General Kitchener, who later became a field marshal in the World War, was busy killing Sudanese natives with his machine gun. Oh, yes, Hitler is an aggressor, and no one questions that statement. But I am old enough to remember in my own lifetime the story of the greater aggressions of Great Britain. And a similar charge can be levied against France. Following the defeat of France in 1871, this republic sought to regain her prestige and self-respect by so-called colonial expansion. Thus, in 1887, the French seized Annam and Tonkin from China and Laos from Siam. Not satisfied with capturing territories in Asia, the French pressed their imperial forces into Africa. Tunis, Madagascar, Djibouti, Dahomey, these were quickly conquered. Then came the secret negotiations by which Paris subjugated Morocco. And finally, there fell before the French legions the Arab dominions in Asia and the German colonies in Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, historical facts neither should be minimized nor disregarded when our sympathies are apt to be warped in discussions which pertain to our neutrality. The Europeans now engaged in warfare display a Europe which is totally foreign to the American mind. A Europe which is totally immersed in the blood bath of injustice. And alas, poor Poland, Christian nation that she is, will be regarded in years to come as the innocent victim of all these pre-arch aggressors of modern times. No one dares applaud Herr Hitler for the land-grabbing that has brought him to the gates of Warsaw. But on the other hand, recognize that Great Britain with an area of 88,000 square miles and a population of 44 million persons rules an empire of more than 18 million square miles and a population of nearly half a billion. And to recognize that France, a country of 212,000 square miles, rules an empire 20 times as large with a population more than twice her own, most of it acquired by unjust aggression since 1871. Let England and France join their vast, far-flung territories, and surely this one third of the world which they control is sufficient to conquer Germany without calling upon the United States to enter that conflict. Christian countries they may be in theory. Democratic nations they may be in the minds of the uninitiated. But by what rule of Christian morality can one condone the activities of England and French statesmen who are responsible for Versailles and responsible for the most indefensible land grabbing in all the history of the world and practically within our lifetime? And as for democracy, in the American concept of the term, it is needless for one to advance any comment. Therefore, recognizing that red-brownism, the new color scheme which the painter from Munich and his Moscow assistants have selected to use in modernizing Europe, is offensive to the moral eyes of Christianity, let us not be enchanted by the purity of the moral color with which England and France have decorated the map of the world. Probably, were our own foreparents alive, were George Washington's spirit capable of addressing us, where the heroes whose corpses long since have rotted at Concord and Lexington, the present occupants of congressional chairs at our nation's capital, probably they would attune our ears to that ancient American council which all of them understood so well. The council of no foreign entanglements. Academic nonsense. Impractical ideas. Are these the reports which the citation of such facts invites from the man in the street, from the unemployed factory worker, from the farmer, and the Wall Street profiteer? Ladies and gentlemen, there are from $8 to $10 billion of French and English money in our nation today available for the purchase of war supplies. In time, all that foreign money plus the profits which accrue to it will whip our idle wheels into action. This will settle the problem of unemployment, the cash and carry advocates say. This will restore prosperity to the poor and profit for the Wall Streeters, the munition manufacturers, the industrialists, is their cry. Such is the materialistic viewpoint expressed by the cash and carry advocates who are hungry for profits, hungry for prosperity. But pause. Must our God-given right to work and a profit be predicated upon destruction? Must the edifice of prosperity be built upon the foundation of torn bodies and maggot-filled skulls? Must the food one eats, the clothing one wears, the shelter one enjoys, be the fruits of participating in an injustice, a double injustice, if you will? Are we Americans and Christians resigned to accept the ungodly economics of prosperity through war? I can readily see why some politicians who were unsuccessful in devising a prosperity of peace will acclaim the opportunity which the cash and carry plan presents. And I can partially understand why some laborers or farmers will advocate the passage of a neutrality bill which includes this indirect participation in a world war. But am I important for an American if I ask this question? Supposing all those in favor cash and carry, including Congress, were compelled to register their names, would they be willing to form the first battalions, to embark first for France, to go over the top first when America directly participates in the World War, which will follow inevitably as a result of their policy of profits through blood? Answer that question. I recognize that it is an idle question. Nevertheless, I am confronted with an historical contingency which likely will happen if, through cash and carryism, we participate indirectly in the war. I am confronted with the probability that some millions of Americans will go to France to become cannon fodder for the money lenders and profiteers if the majority of our congressmen decides to include the cash and carry clause in our neutrality act. When the fatal hour arrives, those who are loudest in clamoring for this government to take the fourth step, which inevitably leads to the last step, they will be the loudest in protesting their inability to carry on. Gentlemen, wars do not beget prosperity. They are the breeders of depression. The bait of the monetary profit that is disclosed to you hides a trap of lifelong servitude which is hidden from you. War production increases mass production. When wars terminate, mass production halts, unemployment increases, wealth vanishes, and radicalism grows apace. Ah, yes. There's the rub. Radicalism. Not that I condemn the unemployed laboring men for demanding a just living wage and all that it implies, for they are within their rights in doing so. Nevertheless, following the last war, when patriotic learned leaders either failed labor all were unheeded by labor. Millions of workmen were prone to follow either unpatriotic or unlearned leaders. Strikes multiplied, private property was seized, government was defied, and in some instances, many of our oppressed fellow Americans grasped the blood-drenched hands of communists. As a result of all this, our nation was in turmoil, while the rulers of the nation persisted in clinging to the abuses of international capitalism, which gave birth to the World War, to the Treaty of Versailles, to the rise of Stalin and Hitler, and to the universal depression which ensued. Yes, those rulers have learned their lesson. The rulers of high finance and the radicalism will never appear again if they can help it. Therefore, see what has happened already in England and France these last 2 weeks. Gone are their democracies, as they call them. A species of totalitarian government and finance has been instituted to fight the totalitarianism of Germany. And what will happen in America? If America becomes embroiled in this present war, I dare predict that emergency measures will be invoked to place us under a dictatorial board of commissioners from which we will never escape. This board will take ample care that the radicalism, which was an outgrowth of the last World War and its consequent depression, will never return. Oh, at least the invisible powers behind government have learned by their mistakes. If the laboring classes did not learn by theirs. Gentlemen, be prepared then to taste the grapes of wrath and eat the black bread of totalitarianism if we take the first step that the inevitable last step of war. Why, therefore, cannot we Americans grasp these simple truths? Namely, that prosperity must be builded upon the economies of faith. That destruction of property and liberty is the fruit of war. That one injustice, if not retracted, generates another injustice. That from the Treaty of Versailles, and long before it and up to the Battle of Warsaw, political injustices have produced and will continue to produce interminable wars. And that the only war and the best war for us to fight is the war for the preservation of our republicanism, of our Christianity, a war against the hostile forces which breed want in the midst of plenty and crime in the midst of want. Ask yourselves who wins this war. And answer yourselves truthfully that no one wins it. Least of all do the laborers and property holders win it. They and their sons mold cannons and machine guns, bare their breasts to shrapnel, pay taxes, lose their jobs, the home. Yes, they, the moral, will sing patriotic songs of joy because they are privileged to serve the international plunder one. And if you must feel resentful regarding the unjust aggressions of Hitler, of England and France, feel doubly indignant insofar as you've been exploited at home by an unsound governmentally protected economic system which is remarkable more for its prices than for its costs. A few days ago, I was approached by an excited parishioner who said, "Father Coughlin, we'd better get into this thing now. We can't stay out of it. Hitler has to be down sooner or later." I went on to explain to this excited gentleman that it was wrong for us to adopt a fatalistic attitude. I warned him that we could keep out of this war by keeping away from the first step that leads to war. I observed for his consideration that no force or combination of forces can stop Hitler until we stop the causes which produce Hitler. I said to him, Fred, what will you gain out of this? What will the world gain out of it?" He replied, "I'll get my job back at Ford, and we'll have the satisfaction of machine gunning that rat Hitler against the wall." Fred has four children, 2, 5, 9, and 11 years old. Questioning him further, I asked, "After the war is over, Fred, how long do you expect to work when the whole world is broke, when the whole world is unable to pay the debts of the last war?" Fred couldn't answer that. "Who'll provide for your children? Children that our parish is taking care of now." To my surprise, he said, "The state will do that job." "Yes, the state. The state did the job in Russia. The state did the job in Germany. And with what results? Do we want the same results in America? We who talk of democracy and do not even know the definition of the word, let alone its implications." "Yes, Fred wants war because he wants a job. And for that job, he is willing to sacrifice his future, his liberty, and his children. The state will take it." "My friends, I fear there are too many threats in this nation of ours. Good men, innocent men, but ill-advised men, who are willing to go back to work under the conditions which existed before 1917. Willing to prosper through the years of a war, and then fatalistically to surrender their religion, their liberties, their homes, and even the future of their children to a group of American commissars who will promise to keep us out of war and to protect our democracy just the same as other men elected to office promise to keep us out of war and make the world safe for democracy. I'm aware that nobody at the present moment is directly campaigning to get America into this world war. But I'm also aware that clever men never campaign directly. This business of getting a nation into war doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow process. It's a well-devised process, carefully thought out by internationalists, by munition manufacturers, by all those who profit from war and upon the blood of its innocent victims. Therefore, I appeal to you to oppose the proposal presented to us by Mr. Saul Bloom and his colleagues under the specious words of cash and power. Cash that means credit, especially, and carry that means carrier, for the troops who will be sent to Europe to ensure the credit of the money change." Ladies and gentlemen, I am anticipating, and with good reason, that Mr. Bloom and those whom he represents will endeavor to persuade the president to call a special session of Congress for the advertised purpose of revising our present neutrality act. But were we able to lift the veil of secrecy, we would discover that the undisclosed purpose is to perpetuate injustice and initiate totalitarianism in America. And what counter-pressure will those of you who disagree with Mr. Bloom exhort upon our president, and particularly upon our congressmen, to prevent the happening of this tragedy? Thanks be to God we still enjoy the rights of American citizens, which includes the right of petition. Therefore, if and when a special session of Congress will be called to consider remodeling our present neutrality act, let us prepare to exercise our right of petition through the agency of millions of telegrams and letters and personal appearances at our congressman's office. Prepare yourselves to act quickly and vigorously on that day of wrath. In this emergency, our America must guard herself not only for war, we must guard ourselves to keep out of war. We must guard ourselves to preserve our liberty. And this means that we must keep from taking that first, the inevitable step of tax and carry. By your opposition to a tax and carry program, let Europe heed the voice of the vicar of the Prince of Peace, who has pleaded for a peace with justice in vain. Let Europe understand that America wants no part of its aggression, that America will take no part in pouring credit into trenches, shell holes, corpses, and desolated cities to perpetuate an injustice. And let America understand that although Christian nations are engaged in this war, it was unchristian deeds which caused the war. Unchristian deeds which up to this date these so-called Christian nations have not repudiated. My friends, just as I finished dictating these words, my secretary handed to me a news dispatch from Washington. It informs us that a special session of Congress will be called by President Roosevelt at some unknown date. It further informs us that Mr. Roosevelt likely will ask Congress to repeal the so-called Neutrality Act and to repeal the arms embargo. This means cash and carry. Ladies and gentlemen, this also means that we are about to choose or reject the first step towards war. This is challenging news to every mother who is a son of military age. This is challenging news to every young wife and sweetheart. This is challenging news to every American who loves his liberty. This is challenging news to every citizen who is mindful of the consequences of the last war and who is gifted with enough intelligence to see beyond the next war. What, therefore, is your reaction, the liberty-loving citizens of America? Shall we keep clear of foreign entanglements and set about to build prosperity on the foundations of peace? Or shall we become participants in the blood business? If Mr. Saul Bloom and his collaborators can bring pressure to bear upon the president and upon the congressmen, cannot this challenging news arouse you who disagree with him to organize Christian American pressure upon these same officials? Can we we keep America out of the blood business? What's your answer? Yes! Can we protect our heritage from the clutches of the international capitalists? What's your answer? Yes! Long therefore the name of your senator and of your representative, according to the right of petition which we American citizens enjoy, advise both your senator and your representative by telegram, by letter, and by personal visit to keep the neutrality bill intact as it exists today without incorporating in it any cash and carry clause, and to keep America free from foreign entanglement. My friend, start this campaign tomorrow. Let no one who loves peace and justice be a slacker. Lest peace and justice perish from all men. And in the meantime, beware of the clever propaganda which will attempt to discredit what I say or lull you into inactivity. Remember that both sides of this European struggle are immersed in the mud of injustice. Remember the results which followed the last war. Remember that cash and carry will deteriorate to credit and carry. Remember that when credit is extended to the Allies, either through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation or through any other subsidiary of the government, soldiers will be sent abroad to safeguard that credit. And those soldiers will be your sons or sweethearts or husbands. In your hands, fellow Americans, the future of civilization is resting today. You and I and every American must stand prepared to act as the good Samaritan. When the last shell will have been fired, when the last corpse will have been buried, to act as the good Samaritan to the unfortunates who are left suffering in the ditch of injustice. Without liberty, without hope, without the wherewithal to build themselves a shelter against the storms of radicalism which always follow war. Therefore, fellow Americans, keep America out of war directly or indirectly. And by so doing, keep fit to help Europe in her hour of need. Keep your heart brave to fight for the American type of neutrality. No cash, no carry, no foreign entanglements, and no blood business for the profiteers. Therefore, begin today. This evening, to campaign among your friends and neighbors for strict neutrality. Begin tomorrow, to petition with individual messages your congressman. God bless you and keep it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin has appealed to you as patriotic Americans to petition your senators and representatives to oppose the cash and carry plan which Mr. Saul Bloom and his associates of New York are advocating, and which Mr. Roosevelt and his government upheld since last spring. Today, tomorrow, and this week, organize your friends to send individual letters or telegrams. Write the letters or send the telegrams when Congress convenes. Do not send the letters or telegrams to Washington until then, because your congressmen are at their home. Organize groups to visit them at their home and there confer with them. In this emergency, everyone must act. Inaction means support for the cash and carry program. Copies of the address to which you have listened are available by writing directly to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. He is anxious to learn of your reaction. Further information is likewise available in Social Justice Magazine, to which we invite you to subscribe. And now, let us join our voices in the Ave Maria. Ladies and gentlemen, instead of the Ave Maria, we find that our time is running short. And so until next week at this same time, we bid you God bless you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address to Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Statements made and views expressed on this program are made on the sole responsibility of the sponsor and do not reflect the views of this station, its management, or personnel. Father Coughlin's address has come to you as a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.